Somebody once asked me, what would you do if you won the lottery? And I jokingly said, I'd do everything I do currently, but accompanied by a mariachi band, which would just both be uplifting and fundamentally amusing. You know, this is Mr. Sutherland. He's here to talk about behavioral science.
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. My guest today is Rory Sutherland. Rory is an author and the vice chairman of Ogilvy. We talk about creativity, the battle between efficiency and invention, how we're neither rational nor irrational, changes in advertising and social norms, evolutionary biology, and more. Please enjoy.
Funnily enough, along with property, there are various fields, okay, where the advertising industry has very little involvement. And it occurs to me that when you have very little advertising involvement, you have very little marketing thinking. And when you have very little marketing thinking, you have very little psychology. And a few of the areas which are, when you think about it, enormous parts of the economy, are fields like generally some forms of transportation. I've always said, by the way, you know, my fantasy advertising account would be Amtrak. Getting Americans to use trains would just be just a really fantastic kind of marketing challenge.
Good luck.
I know. If you ever have the time, I've been on Amtrak, it's fantastic. There's that kind of thing. But there's in particular property, real estate, education. Okay, there's very little kind of really second order investigation of the motivations going on. And actually the potential gains, I think, for entrepreneurs who are prepared to ask those second order questions in fields like, for example, some forms of not American healthcare, but British healthcare, which is largely nationalized, that, you know, the fantastic opportunity there. And the real estate market, education are three of those kind of areas which are in some ways unmined. They're kind of untapped for their, you know, for the potential for really deep psychological insight. I'll give you a tip for real estate, okay? Which is what you might call the second order question in real estate, which is people now choose online, which I think is a mistake, by the way. I think that actually a property search should be recursive. And actually there's a lot to be said for having a human real estate agent to show you things you didn't know you wanted, okay? But nevertheless, they then look at pictures of the house. Now, what are they doing? Why is it that if you have a house in shitty condition or a house with really naff furniture, it's literally at a 30% or 20% discount to an equivalent house, which is really well furnished? All right? Because let's face it, when you get into the place, you're going to redecorate. Right? Okay? May take you a month. It may take you 2 years. But you're not stuck with the former owner's decor. And I think what it is people use the photographs to make an inference about the type of person who lived in the house beforehand. And therefore, if the decor suits their own tastes, they go, that's the right kind of place to live for someone like me. And so they're making social status-based inferences from what they see. And there are other really weird findings, like if you have a stair lift or any kind of disability equipment, or it looks like the previous occupant was old, young people massively discount the thing. Now, my view is I don't care how a stair lift would be quite useful because you can put a case of beer on it and carry it upstairs. You know, you don't have to ride on the thing. But those things seem to be a kind of kiss of death in real estate terms. And it's worth asking the question why, because there's a huge arbitrage opportunity there, effectively, buying those places, okay, banging in a bit of IKEA furniture and a bit of Scandinavian shit, right? And then walking away with a massive profit. Simply by revising effectively the assumptions that the viewer makes about who the previous occupants were. And so, I suspect it's pretty easy. We can find this out, okay? But I suspect it's pretty easy to sell celebrity homes. All right? You just say, so-and-so used to live here. The association is good enough.
Right.
But then there might be another opportunity, which is getting celebrities to live in places very, very briefly so you can sell them at a huge margin. I didn't think of that, but that might be my next business. But no, those areas are fascinating precisely because they don't have ad budgets in the conventional way. They don't tend to have marketing departments. And so they don't tend to do much market research. And so I think, you know, they don't have the same. I mean, if you look at, you know, the depth of information P&G will have on shaving, right? I think I spoke to someone at Procter & Gamble who said they had something like 30,000 hours of film footage of men shaving, right? Just looking for the insights. And they noticed this funny little thing about the moustache bit under your nose. So they added a little blade that's designed to deal with that, you know. So you look at the kind of depth of thinking that P&G deploy in designing a new Gillette razor. And then you contrast that with what goes on in actually far larger sectors of the economy. And you realize, okay, there's a pretty big deep understanding deficit in all of these places.
Yeah, there's perception arbitrage available.
Yeah.
I like that.
That's exactly the way to put it. Yeah, perceptual arbitrage is... I mean, the example I always give, which fascinates me, there in the last sort of 15 years in London, two new significant lines have opened. One of them is the Elizabeth line. It cost about £20 billion, actually, and involved boring through great depths of London to create an entirely new line. And the other one is a thing called the Overground, which was a line that always, or actually it was kind of concatenation of rail lines, kind of orbiting the city with a few spurs going into the middle, which always kind of existed, okay? But it wasn't on the tube map. Nobody knew what to call it. Nobody knew how it fitted in with their other journey plans. Now, what's interesting is they spent a few million pounds, actually probably 100 million or so, improving the rolling stock, the lighting of the stations, you know, the engineering stuff. They built, I think they added a few extra miles of track connecting two separate bits of the line. But basically, the engineering cost was in the millions rather than the billions. Now, the interesting thing is that line now carries the same number of passengers in a day as the £20 billion Elizabeth line, and yet it was mostly achieved perceptually. In other words, add the thing to the overall tube map, give it a brand identity, give it a color as a line. And to give you just an anecdotal story about that, I had some friends in London who back in the 1990s, early 90s, before the Overground was called the Overground, they lived about 250 yards from an Overground station called, which was called Clapham High Street. And I asked them once, because driving to see them, I noticed Clapham High Street station. And I said to them, I said, where do the trains go from Clapham High Street station? And one of them didn't know. The other one didn't even know the station existed. It didn't even feature on their kind of itinerary planning repertoire, okay? And so, you know, quite often you can create value through perception much, much more cheaply than you can through engineering or through infrastructure. And yet we don't spend much time trying to do it. And that strikes me as weird. And I think the reason is, there are lots of reasons, but I think the reason is we always give the bloody problems to rational people first, like engineers or economists or, you know, transport consultants. And they then define the potential value in engineering terms. And once you do that, it's too late to re-ask the question behaviorally, psychologically, perceptually.
So you have to start with that from the get-go. This is going to dovetail nicely into one of the key questions I wanted to ask, which is, We often arrive at conclusions or findings that we couldn't even have fathomed at the outset. I think in particular, when you take this kind of constrained engineering rational approach that you just mentioned, in light of this, how do we design our lives or businesses to optimize for the kind of randomness and variance that leads to these novel discoveries?
There aren't very many people. I mean, the reason I work in advertising is not only because I think advertising is quite important, but it's one of very few places which actually gives you a home. This has always been the case, if you're a little bit of a misfit. And it suddenly occurred to me, it took me years to learn this, that the qualities that are prized in, let's say, an advertising agency, or a good advertising agency, to be accurate, are slightly reviled in most other areas of business. Because the second you say anything whimsical or eccentric, or you suggest redefining the problem, or you suggest rewriting the question, or you know, those various things, okay. Now, you'd think people would go, that person is a really good thinker. They're looking at this from lots of different directions, you know. But so, it's a home, I think, for the non-neurotypical, apart from anything else. So, you'd think people go, that's really useful. That's a really valuable exercise, because before we start plowing on with activity, okay, you're actually doing the Einstein thing of spending 55 minutes to define the problem and then 5 minutes solving it. Okay. Now, you'd think that would be a prized quality. It really isn't, because you're seen as not a safe pair of hands. Whereas if you proceed immediately in a completely linear and logical way, you're seen as a very sensible person, you know, bit of a go-getter, gets things done, etc. Now, the other creative quality, which is absolutely maddening to anybody else, is that you procrastinate. And the reason you do that is because you're waiting for inspiration to strike. There's no point in getting started until I've got a good or interesting idea on which to base my work. And that makes you look lazy. And the funniest thing happened, I met a guy who'd been a consultant for many years and found himself completely like a fish out of water. And he had a boss who was, well, should we say a consultant, but he also suspected his boss was like, you know, high functioning on the spectrum. And this is the absolute kind of case of creative, the creative disparity, the difference between how creative people would do something and how rational people would do it. And Rick Rubin would be a fantastic pair. The job takes as long as it takes. Okay, you know, don't say how long does it take to do this. It takes as long as it takes. Okay. Now, the point I make there is that his boss had tasked him every week with writing and then distributing an email newsletter, which went out on Fridays. Okay. Now, if you write frequently or you do any kind of writing, this will strike you as immediately and obviously absurd. And one of the things the boss did to keep him on his toes was to demand that he wrote 20% of the newsletter on Monday, 20% on Tuesday, 20% on Wednesday, right? That every day was dedicated to a fifth of the newsletter. Now, no writer, no creative person, okay? I mean, you know, they're novelists who have to basically produce their 1,000 words a day. You know, Virgil wrote 8 lines of the Aeneid every day or whatever it was. Okay, there are cases where you can do that if you have a huge amount of spare time and you just have to get on with it. But most writers would not do that. They'd wait until they had a really interesting idea for the headline of the newsletter, and then they'd write the whole thing on Friday. Now, actually, that's not the best thing to do, by the way. I would say the best thing to do is to do that, procrastinate, have a burst of kind of creative activity on Thursday, sleep on it overnight, and then edit on Friday. It's probably the best way to write a newsletter that has to go out weekly. And also share it with a few other people on Friday, because you may have written something that you think is clear and which other people find incomprehensible or contradictory or something. But that business of you must write 20% of the newsletter by Monday and I want 20% finished by Tuesday, it's completely at odds with really how anybody in a creative space sets about solving a problem. And their first thing they will do is spend long time comfortably in a state of uncertainty, where they're happy not knowing, not being sure. They're waiting for inspiration to strike. They're waiting for the whole thing to take shape in their minds. And, you know, it's the old John Lennon quote, time spent doing nothing is very rarely wasted. That will appear to other people as if they're just hopelessly procrastinating, or that they're lazy, or that they're not really, you know, they're not really committed to the job in hand. And so I think that, you know, the way in which we see things at from two mental frames of what being an efficient worker means. Okay. One person going that, you know, if you are busy every moment of the day, you are being efficient. That's the dumb thing at one extreme, you know. The other extreme, we know the other extreme, which is endless procrastination, missing deadlines, etc. But I mean, there is a point that Bill Birnbach made, which is that clients remember a great ad for longer than they remember it was 2 weeks late. And there is that Rick Rubin point. Look, these things just take as long as they take. And by the way, you know, why does the email newsletter have to be weekly anyway? You know, if you did send it out on Monday, it's not like, you know, I mean, unless you're some genius, it's not like people are going on Friday, where is my newsletter, right? You know, I mean,
part of the problem here is so many of the people who would like to push back on these assumptions that define the scope and environment of their work are in mid-management positions or doing the day-to-day work such that they don't have the power to question those assumptions, so they have to slot in. So it starts either top down, or you have to break away outside of the system to define that work environment.
So essentially, what we do is we select for, we promote for, And we also train for reductionist thinking, really. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that there's this huge creative deficit in the economy, really, which has been caused by the narrow pursuit of efficiency measures or just quantification in general at the expense of experimentation, imagination, and invention, actually. It's why, if you think about it, with a few exceptions, there are a few really interesting exceptions of genuine innovation from large companies, but they're weirdly few. Obviously, the iPhone, okay? Obviously, the Nespresso machine, the IBM PC, etc. But the pace of invention there seems to have stopped. And I think that's also caused by the way, I kind of blame the press for this, actually, which is news coverage of anything, particularly if you're American or British, is relentlessly negative, and it's relentlessly negative about the country you live in. So to read the British press, you think everything in Britain is an absolute heap of shit. Things in America, another kind of English-speaking country, they're pretty shit too. But you'd think that kind of places like, you know, whether it's South Africa or France or Germany, okay, you'd think they're basically a paradise, all right? And it leads to this extraordinary negativity bias, I think, which is that, you know, there's nothing we can do. There are no further opportunities. We can't really improve things. All we can do is basically cut costs and, you know, make things just a little bit cheaper and nastier and more efficient. And the kind of buccaneering, pioneering spirit, which characterized America in the 50s, obviously, but also America, my headphones have fallen off. America for, you know, most of the early part of the, well, right the way up to the Reagan era, really. That's completely gone. And there's no reason. We're richer than we were, okay? There's technology to make things possible. There's absolutely no reason. You know, we have, I think, you know, one other reason to be optimistic and to innovate is we have an understanding of psychology now, which is, well, I won't say better, but it's 20% less shit than it was, you know, 50 years ago. And yet we have this weird mentality that, you know, we have a kind of scarcity mentality. We're acting, you know, at a time of great abundance, we're kind of acting as though we're starving. And that's probably, I think, my wacko theories, I'm perfectly happy to get vaccinated. Okay. I don't believe that Bill Gates was trying to put a chip in my arm, but I've always had this weird theory that actually Milton Friedman was a Russian agent. Okay. Now bear with me for a second. Which is that what you did by creating the shareholder value movement in business, an obsession with financial quantification, quarterly reporting, okay, et cetera, is you effectively made businesses, you imbued businesses with exactly the same problem that beset Soviet organizations, which is everything became dominated by targets and measures and a five-year plan. Everything became hugely risk-averse. There was no incentive to do things differently because, you know, in the act of experimentation, you might miss your target for, you know, June in, you know, whatever it is, fertilizer manufacturing, whatever. And you're creating a kind of culture, which I call Soviet-style capitalism, where instead of having, who would you have had? You would have had you had the Metchura, and then you had apparatchiks and all those sort of people. Okay. And those have been replaced in the West by people like the finance function, procurement, compliance, okay, HR, okay. And you have this massive expansion in the bureaucratic administrative class, really not to add any value at all to the economy, but simply to facilitate the agglomeration of numbers for reporting upwards. And so, you know, in some ways, the shareholder value movement, not necessarily intentionally, unless you believe my Milton Friedman was a Soviet age theory. Okay. But he might as well have been. Because the fundamental problem, I think, is that, I mean, I said this on a podcast with Russ Roberts, which is, and he's one of my icons, Russ. And he took the clip and like rebroadcast it, which is that the fundamental narrative about capitalism is wrong anyway, because we have this stupid economic narrative that capitalism is efficient. Well, it's not. I mean, it's unbelievably wasteful. In fact, competition is, in many fields, totally wasteful, okay? at least by standard economic measures. Now, I mean, the reason capitalism is great is because it's inventive and adaptive. And it can solve the same mechanism. Problem in multiple different ways rather than creating a kind of averaged optimization. And so the fact that, you know, capitalism, as I said, you know, I mean, the Russians could kind of produce tractors, but they never really came up with Red Bull. Okay, they never really came up with, you know, they never really came up with Coke. They didn't really come up with, but I mean, those are trivial examples, but the inventive nature of capitalism is really what its unique selling point is. And instead, we've turned it into this arid kind of narrative around efficiency gains. And I do blame that on a kind of cultural change that happened within the business world, where it became increasingly financialized. The people who once existed to serve the value creators in an organization suddenly elevated themselves to administrators and started bossing the value creators around. Now, what happens if you're going to miss your quarterly target in, let's say, a business, okay? You get rid of the people whose productivity you're measuring. But the fact that you're measuring their productivity means that, by definition, they are actually productive. Okay, right? Because, right? Okay. So you go and say, okay, we could actually do this same work if we sweated people to bollocks. We could actually produce the same work with 15% fewer people. So let's do that, right? And they go and get rid of 15% of the productive workforce. No one knows how productive the actual administrator is, the finance function, because there's no way of actually measuring what they produce. And their value is debatable in many cases. Now, that's not to say there are really, really great finance people who are insightful, who understand the problems, etc. But my God, the size of that kind of bureaucratic workforce is just terrifyingly huge. Don't get me wrong. I would not start a business without a really shit-hot finance person, because it's an essential part of the mix. I'm just saying that the extent to which ancillary functions actually police value-creating functions has become ridiculous. So you have this in universities now, where at the University of Cambridge, at the University Library in Cambridge, which is one of five copyright libraries in the UK, which means they're required to keep a copy of every single book published. It's a remarkable kind of thing. And they went, a lot of academics were told, you have to tell us which books are no longer acceptable, that can't be kept on open access. Right? Now, and they asked the academics to start nominating books effectively to be banned. Now, just to be clear here, the people doing this were not themselves academics. They were library administrators. I mean, what the hell is going on when you have a bunch of effing librarians basically telling experts that you have to nominate books which are unacceptable? Okay. This is a complete reversal of any sensible status hierarchy, where in a hospital, doctors should carry a level of status that's higher than, administrators or pen pushers. In an ad agency, you know, in a software company, the coders should carry quite a lot of status because they actually are the people who are doing the real work for which the organization exists. I mean, I think there's a problem with this, not just economically in terms of the waste, in terms of bureaucracy and misdirected effort. I think there's an anthropological problem with it as well, because effectively, there are whole things. Think of medicine, right? I mean, Goldman Sachs has this phrase, which is your rabbi. Okay, in medicine, you have a guy who is more experienced than you, to whom you attach yourself, and there's a kind of symbiotic relationship, which is I'll help you out, and you've got my back. And you realize that to some extent, your success stands and falls with that other person. It's kind of sophisticated chimp stuff. It's a prestige economy, not a dominance economy, if you like, in terms of status, but it's still kind of chimp stuff. And if you have a position where, you know, the senior cardiac surgeon doesn't really decide who gets promoted or what they can get paid or who gets fired, but that job, which used to be part of their overall function, has suddenly become specialized to a kind of support function. And that support function then becomes dominant, not least because it hasn't got that much to do, right? There's a limit to how much time a surgeon can spend playing kind of power games, because he's quite busy like chopping people open occasionally. Whereas the people in the bureaucracy can effectively create their own work. And that violates a whole sort of, kind of primate rule, really, of, how power and respect get conferred. And I think and the other thing I think we need to talk about is actually a really interesting thing, which is the complete elimination of what you might call discretionary perks from business life. So, I mean, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years ago, certainly 20 years ago, okay, if you're a reasonably senior person in a bank or a law firm, you could kind of go and entertain people and have a bit of a jolly, and maybe you were sociable, maybe you weren't, but there are a whole load of kind of quite enjoyable things which came as part of your employment, okay? Now, for various reasons, often it's something like compliance legally in the pharmaceutical industry or the banking industry, all of that is gone. I mean, really, really gone. Now, the only problem with that is if you then have basically you do work and you get a salary and there's no kind of extraneous kind of perkery around what you do, your relationship with your employer then becomes completely transactional. It's no longer a relationship in the sense of mutual trust, mm-hmm. reciprocality, reciprocation. Look, I'll take these people out, in return, we'll do a bit of this, which is to some extent part of what makes humans kind of capitalist, which is the understanding that you perform lots and lots of value exchanges that don't necessarily appear on a balance sheet. And if you take that out, the whole thing looks very neat and efficient, but it's also fundamentally a bit hollow. Now, I'm not arguing for absolute, debauchery by any means. I'm just saying that actually the odd bit of a shared curry in an evening, that kind of stuff. If you take all of that away, it doesn't really save very much money. And I suspect it's costly in the medium to long term. But it's one of those things that strikes me as making effectively what it's doing is infantilizing people. Because even if you reach a high level of seniority, you're still told, where you sit in the plane on a flight under 4 hours, where you sit on a plane if the flight's over 4 hours. You're left literally in a world where you're painting by numbers. You can make no discretionary judgments over anything because it's all codified and kind of reduced to algorithmic laws. And we like exercising some degree. We like exercising autonomy. Okay. Yeah. We really, really like exercising autonomy. And the autonomy doesn't have to be complete. You obviously have to provide guardrails around individual autonomy in the organization. But when it gets reduced to zero, that's when it gets really depressing. And that's why I think you see this, by the way, the working from home movement is in some respects an unspoken strike, isn't it? The refusal to come back into the office. Because if you look at the extent to which the balance of power has shifted from labor to capital, this is a Marxist diagnosis. I'm not remotely Marxist, I'm conservative. But if you look at that balance of power shifting from labor to capital, what's actually happened? Okay, so first of all, there used to be a large amount of commitment to your employer, but in return, they gave you some measure of job security. That's gone. Okay. Then, when you come into the office, you actually have worse tech than you have at home, and you get to sit in an open plan office with everybody else. And there is no choice because now some people would rather a library. Some people would like their office to be a pub, but there is absolutely no choice. So you have no control over your working environment because it's an open plan office or it's cubicles, okay? Which were decisions taken, again, entirely to save costs with absolutely no evidence about their effect on productivity. In fact, there is evidence, but it suggests that the productivity of open plan offices goes down, okay? Then you look at an even wider framework, which is in the 1950s, if your partner worked, you had two salaries, right? And that was great for a time. The two salary household was great until property prices caught up, right? So you've now lost in your household or in your family 40 hours of discretionary time a week, which was the time your wife or husband had through not working, which was there to take care of children, household tasks, getting the car fixed, all that stuff. You've lost all that, okay? And in return, assuming you earn the same as your partner, okay, you're working for you, and your partner is effectively working to shovel money into the gullet of the rentier economy, the rent-seeking economy of property ownership, mm-hmm. you know, all those kind of utterly non-productive areas of the economy where effectively, you know, I mean, our own staff in London, okay, after we paid them money, after they've paid tax, 50% of their remaining money goes on property costs and transportation costs, none of which are really discretionary, right? Then you add technology, which meant that suddenly it was perfectly okay to expect people to work at 10 o'clock in the evening. Okay, right. And suddenly, you know, time that was effectively 100% free time got impinged on because, you know, effectively with the age of the mobile phone, it was acceptable for people to expect you to work more or less at all hours. All right. And you had no control over your inbox either. There's no filter. And by the way, forget about having a PA or secretary to actually filter the incoming stuff because they were cut ages ago. Okay. So you have all this shit that's been heaped on knowledge workers. All right. In return for what exactly? All right. Now, first of all, you get these absolutely stupid pieces in the newspaper going, oh, look, everybody's going back to the office. The flexible working revolution has been proved to be a failure. Actually, the intelligent people investigating are saying nothing of the kind. Nobody's suggesting you should work remotely 100% of the time, okay? But at the same time, if you can save a huge amount of money, you know, in transportation costs, or you can live further away from a city center by dint of working remotely, that's a pretty high equivalent to a pretty high pre-tax pay rise, okay, in terms of just shifting money from your discretion, from non-discretionary expenditure to discretionary expenditure. Secondly, if there is really this 3% decline in productivity, okay, that's fine. Just say, okay, you have to work an extra half hour a day if you work remotely. Everybody will take that deal, okay? Yeah. But thirdly, it completely fails to notice that with the normalization of remote working, new technologies will arise, whether they be websites or actually hardware or whatever, which will make remote working more and more productive and more effective. But I don't blame those people who basically said, I'm not going back. I do blame the people who say I'm never going back. But the people who say I'm not going in 5 days a week, and if you want me to do that, I'm off. They're absolutely right. And by the way, I mean, okay, think about this, okay? In the United States, you perpetrate an extraordinary act of injustice on your population by not giving them any mandatory paid leave. I mean, I think there is some. Is that right? But Bernie Sanders suggested 4 weeks of paid leave a year, and people reacted as if he was bonkers. But I mean, the whole of continental Europe, in fact, the whole of the world outside North America and Japan and China basically operates with generous vacation allowances. I've never met anybody in Britain so right-wing that they say, you know, we could grow GDP by 2% by cutting people's holiday. And in the same way, just as there's a status quo bias here, okay, there's a status quo bias with flexible working. You know, no one who'd ever experienced 4 weeks vacation would ever go back to two. And no one who'd experienced a degree of flexible working, unless you go to work at Goldman Sachs, which is one of the entities. Now, in demanding people go back into the office 5 days a week, by the way, and in bigging up the advantages of co-location, we might also want to ask to what extent these organizations are invested in the commercial property market, okay? Which has a fairly major vested interest in pretending that office space is really necessary. So I think what will happen is we'll come up with imaginative solutions which both benefit the worker and save some money. You know, you could have companies alternating, sharing the same space, just as, you know, some sports teams share a stadium, for example. You know, I think all the thing that annoys me about the people who are completely hostile to this idea is you're judging an idea which was imposed on us very, very rapidly without allowing for any benefits that might arise from further experimentation.
Which is a meta point on the entire conversation about the movement towards efficiency and away from inventiveness. Mm-hmm. We were forced into this situation in COVID and have an opportunity to do this grand experiment with remote work and maybe aren't giving ourselves the latitude to see it through.
When we judge things, It isn't right. To be honest, in innovation, rich people and status symbols have played a disproportionate part in funding the early stages of innovative ideas. Because innovative ideas in their early stages are usually worse than established ideas. Okay? And so things like the car, in the very, very early days of the car, it was worse than a horse. The early days of the typewriter, okay, well, actually, until it got to a word processor, it was worse than handwriting, right? But status seeking, in other words, the urge, neophilia, the urge to be seen with the latest thing, is what funded the early stage development of those businesses. And a lot of businesses work like that. Their early stages are really supported. Flat screen TVs, okay? That, you know, I had a same friend who worked for Goldman Sachs, you know, had this TV, which if I looked at it now, I think it was absolute shit, but it was the first flat screen TV I'd seen. And I thought it was, you know, and I think it was £6,000 or something, about $8,000. Okay. You could buy one now. Actually, you couldn't buy one that small, but you could kind of buy one now. You could buy one now twice the size for kind of, you know, I don't know, $1,000, $800 less. And so that function of status seeking in terms of funding innovation is interesting because what happens is that in its early stages, something that's new is generally has faults, which have been ironed out with the previous solution to that same problem.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I say about electric cars is, look, there are all these people going on about electric cars. They're not as good as petrol cars. Ooh, there's the range. Okay. My point is that vehicles of any kind, car-like objects, okay, powered by electric motors, which are very small and incredibly efficient, all right, will enable a kind of Cambrian explosion in innovation in transportation. We're already seeing it with electric bikes, with electric cargo bikes, okay, which is the electric motor shits on the internal combustion engine. I did have a really mischievous suggestion to some people in the car industry, which is to promote electrification in Britain on patriotic grounds, on the grounds that the internal combustion engine, the diesel engine, and the petrol engine are the only forms of motive power not invented in the UK, and therefore they're fundamentally unnatural. Okay, I mean, Faraday kind of invented the electric motor. Watt invented the steam engine. Okay, you had the guy Pearson who invented the turbine. You know, there was a Welsh guy actually who invented the hydrogen fuel cell. Right. Huge amounts of this motive power stuff happened here. And the electric motor is literally, you know, unbelievably simple and elegant by comparison with the internal combustion engine. Just in terms of, I had my electric car serviced and I took it in for a service and they got back to me and they said, yeah, the tires are fine and the brakes are fine. I said, well, what about all the other shit? And they said, well, there isn't really any other shit. Okay. So I got them to replace the HEPA filter for the cabin air filter just to give them something to do. I kind of felt sorry for them because people were there going, ooh, you know, yeah, you'll probably be needing a new air filter next time round. We've looked at the oil and we've changed this. There's none of that stuff. Okay. It's just energy motion software. Now, the potential for producing like really, really small cars, cargo bikes with electric motors, what we can do in terms of transportation once we're electrified is literally 100 times more innovative than what we can do with gasoline vehicles, where there are just constraints and the sheer complexity makes it necessarily expensive and difficult to maintain, okay? Whereas the electric vehicle, I mean, one of my weird predictions is that once somebody starts mass producing an electric motorhome, an electric RV, okay, I think a portion of the younger population will actually go nomadic because property prices are so high. Once you've got some nice electric RV, which has like 150 kilowatt hours of juice sitting underneath, which doesn't add much to the weight of a good RV, you can basically, I don't know what you do for pooing, and that's the big hole. We need to invent the electric toilet, some sort of microwave device that takes care of your effluvium, okay, and stopping it smelling in some interesting way. But other than actually pooing, you can basically live off the grid with complete domestic comfort, complete connectivity, okay? Well, why would you buy a house when you can drive one, okay? You know, now, I don't know about that. I mean, it's very difficult to predict, but it seems to me a perfectly rational decision to take. You know, that, you know, if you lived in LA, well, you know, you'd take your house down to the coast for the weekend, wouldn't you? Right? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it doesn't seem to be a crazy thing to do. Yeah. But equally, at the very small end, let's look at electric cargo bikes. The problem with the bike is it's kind of, it works extremely well in very narrow use cases. If you've got nice weather, it's reasonably flat. You don't have any luggage. You're reasonably fit. And you can cope with a high level of discomfort. Because if you get rid of any of those things, you make the bike too inefficient to be worthwhile. I mean, one of the dirty secrets of cycling is that unless you're kind of Lance Armstrong, probably not a great example, but you get my point. Unless you're Lance Armstrong uphill, they're not much faster than walking. Okay. Now, once you add a bit of electric oomph to that, suddenly you can have large panniers or trailers to tow to store luggage. You can have a much more comfortable seat. Okay. You can go uphill at totally reasonable speeds without exhausting yourself. You know, I mean, there are whole cities which are totally Lisbon, for example, or, you know, Bath. Very hilly cities are totally ill-suited to cycling. It's all very well for the Dutch to go on about it. But I mean, at the largest point in Amsterdam, they actually took the top off because it was embarrassing. The highest point geographically in Amsterdam was actually the top of a rubbish heap. Okay. So they realized this was slightly embarrassing and they slightly flattened the rubbish heap. But I mean, it's a perfect city for cycling. It's really, really flat. Now, actually, when you add electric bikes, electric scooters, and actually just little pods we ride around in, okay, individually or in a couple, or maybe in a group of four, which drive at about 30 miles an hour and get you there at a pre-specified time. You know, those kind of things are really, really interesting. And it's daft to say petrol good, electric bad. You have to ask yourself the question, which one has the greater potential for further unanticipated innovation?
Shifting gears slightly, fundamentally, your job is about trying to predict the consistently irrational ways in which humans behave. Mm. How often
they're
are
not irrational.
You learning?
They're not irrational. They're often unconscious. And since we always consciously describe what seems to sound rational, and yet unconsciously we're driven to do something else, that doesn't necessarily mean what we're doing is irrational. It may mean that our instinct contains a higher form
it's
of rationality to which narrow rationality is Nassim Taleb actually calls it naive rationality, i.e. something with the appearance of rationality or mathematically that seems rational, which isn't actually sensible in reality.
So would you call that intuition?
Yeah. So actually, intuition, deep motivation, okay? You know, I mean, you know, there are also all kinds of Darwinian things going on about reproduction and survival, which lead us in a particular course of action without needing to be consciously explained, if you like. I remember being in a meeting about pensions. How do you get young people to save for pensions? And I said, look, there are lots of things you can do. You know, you can communicate it differently. You can design the pension differently so that young people get a drawdown facility. All right. So, you know, if you've got £10,000 in a pension, you desperately need £3,000. Why don't you let people just pull this money down and then pay it back again gradually? You don't need to, you know, you don't need to do to make it absolutely, you know, wave goodbye to your money for 30 years. But I said, at some level, what you have to remember is that instinctively, people in their 20s are probably keener on finding a high quality life partner or parent than they are on actually maximizing long-term survival prospects. And I said, you know, I said, I don't know because I've never been on Tinder, but my guess is there aren't many 20-year-olds on Tinder boasting about their pension provision, right? Instead, what you want to do is buy a Mustang and photograph. I don't know whether that works either, to be honest. But I mean, you know, but what I'm saying is that it's not your priority at that stage in your life because there are other more important things that you have to focus on first in order for your pension to be actually meaningful, like having someone to spend your retirement with, perhaps. And so quite a lot of stuff, you know, the narrow economic view is, well, the earlier you start saving, the better you can have a retirement. Well, not if you miss out. Now, by the way, I said not many people on Tinder age 25 boast about their pension provision. It's just not very sexy. I bet there are a load of 70-year-olds on Tinder who are boasting like hell about their pension. But that's a different kind of, that's a different life stage. But right. I think understanding what people are really trying to do, even if they're not aware they're trying to do it, that's the real task in kind of behavioral science. And actually, I think that business of condemning people for their rationality simply because they deviated from very narrow economic models, that was kind of dumb, I think.
How often are you truly learning something new about human nature versus simply reminding yourself of a key axiom? And are you actually in search of the truth about human nature or behavior, or are you really in search of what's useful?
You mentioned earlier on Shane Parris, our Canadian, mutual Canadian friend, who is a wonderful writer. He's written 3 books, actually, and also wonderful sort of discussant on all matters behavioral science. He's really a kind of Charlie Munger devotee, I think. But here's my point. I think where Shane is absolutely right is we're not looking for a Newton here, right? We're not looking for a universal law of everything. What we're looking for is a better toolkit. And actually, I'm very much against this kind of, you know, what a Hindu friend of mine calls monotheism, by analogy with monotheism, which is you have to have one theory to explain everything or it's not a proper science. I don't think we'll get to that in psychology. Now, what you do arguably want to do is think less like Newton and a bit more like Darwin, which is we want theories not about how things are and how things will always be, which is physics. We want theories about how things change. And by the way, I'll make a point about this, which is a large part of the difference between conservatives and liberals isn't actually a difference of opinion in the direction of travel. It's a difference of opinion in the speed of travel. Because I think one thing about young people who tend to be radical and left-wing is not that they're wrong. It's they're absurdly impatient about the pace of change because they've only been adults for 7 years and they haven't really seen the playing out of long-term changes. Now, to make this not non-controversial and to avoid getting cancelled, I'll talk about something like drink driving, okay, where, first of all, everybody just drove when they were drunk and nobody cared and it wasn't even a legal offence. Then in my parents' generation, it was a legal offence. You could be breathalyzed. We don't have the distinction. You have driving under the influence and driving while intoxicated. We don't even have that distinction. We have just, if you're breathalyzed, you're over the limit. That's it. You'll lose your license for a year. And insuring your car in the future will be monstrously expensive. Okay. I think it's probably, we probably should have an intermediate penalty, but we don't. Maybe not. Maybe we're right. I don't know. That's, again, one of those questions, right? But in my parents' generation, it was illegal to do it. And the penalty was very strict. But a lot of people did it. Now, my parents didn't. But my parents would allow people to leave their homes and drive home in a state of intoxication. So that's what you achieve with legality. But then over time, a new social norm became established where it was considered not that, oh, he got caught over the limit. Naughty step, right? It was considered kind of not really embarrassing. It was considered a bit of a kind of naughty boy action to get caught driving drunk. And now in my children's generation, by contrast, they would wrestle the car keys from someone's hand if they even contemplated getting into a car while in any state of intoxication. Now that change, okay, you know, the change in general societal actions, or the change in acceptance of, say, smoking in public places, this sort of thing, okay, they're 10, 15, 20-year projects. You know, you could argue some of them are very fast. Same-sex marriage was fast, okay? Some of them are literally, you know, well, I mean, 150 years to go from one state to another state. And so one reason why young people tend to be radical is they're not really familiar with the fact that they think that if something is changing in the right direction, then it must be far too slow. And if you once you get to about, you know, 50, you realize that If you take wokery, okay, well, you want people to be sincerely woke, not woke because they're frightened for their jobs. It's a bit like drunk driving, right? Okay, right. You don't want a kind of world where nobody says anything officially and nobody will tweet anything, but as soon as they get together with a bunch of drunk mates, they actually become really unpleasant. Okay, you want this to be sincere. And for it to be actually absorbed and socially codified and normalized, that takes a long time. The other thing is that the young people are desperate for absolute context-free rules on everything. Not quite sure why that is, but the other way in which you judge things like language, okay, has to be contextually sensitive, okay? So in a military platoon, they will all be incredibly rude to each other, all right? Which will extend to all forms of kind of abuse. Now, if you heard that, my friend Rob Henderson makes this point that when he was in the USAF, he said, you know, 1 minute of mess banter in the USAF, you know, if that happened at Yale, they'd close the whole place and have it fumigated. But on the other hand, the people who are abusing each other in the USAF would also die for each other, which certainly isn't true at Yale. People wouldn't even, you know, have the lecture notes at Yale, whereas these people would die for each other. So you also have to understand the whole complexity thing, which is there are certain social settings in which the rules for language actually change. And there seems to be this weird desperation in the young for kind of dogma. And I think it leads them astray in two ways, one of which is you condemn things which would once have been excusable when people were allowed to make subjective contextual value judgments. But you also forgive things which you should slightly disparage, all right? So I'll give you an example of this. Just because something is legal doesn't mean it's okay, right? There are lots of things which are legal. You might say marital infidelity, okay? You might take divorce, okay? They're all, quite correctly, they're all legal, okay? You can't get arrested for having an extramarital affair. But it's still not a good thing, right? Okay? On balance, we learned over years of experience that there can be catastrophic effects on children from, for example, you know, losing, you know, not having a parent and so on. Not always. And it'd be totally wrong to discriminate against someone because they hadn't grown up in a two-parent family. That would be nuts, okay, and abominable. But on the balance of probabilities, it's better to grow up with two parents than one. Not even saying of either gender, by the way, but just two seems to be better than one. Okay, I don't know the data on the other stuff. And so you tend to have this weird thing. If you're very dogmatic, you err in two directions. You're too unwilling to forgive certain things, and you're probably too willing to forgive other things because your parameters are set by what can be easily defined, not by intuitive moral judgment. And I think that is a problem. You know, I don't know why it is a facet of the young, whether it's a product of the education system, of people always wanting to find a right answer to everything. I don't know. I'd like to inquire more. But generally, there was a kind of contextual understanding that what's okay in a comedy club isn't okay at a funeral. Unless it's a funeral of a comedian, of course, in which case the rules change again. I mean, there's a famous John Cleese narration to, I think, might have been the death of Graham Chapman, one of his fellow Pythons, where he just spends his entire funeral oration effectively abusing the dead person. Okay. But in comedic circles, that's okay, because in different contexts, different rules apply. And so this kind of, I think there's something fundamentally non-human about it, of wanting to actually have absolutely hard and fast invariant rules for everything, which aren't, I mean, you know, I'll give it again a non-controversial suggestion. I don't really agree with speed cameras because speed cameras both ignore people they should be arresting and arrest people they should be ignoring because they only have one rule, which is now, I personally think at the very least, speed camera footage should be recorded and sent to a human being who has a certain dispensation to say it was 3 o'clock in the morning, there are no pedestrians because it's a dual carriageway. There was nobody else on the road. Going 46 in a 40 limit isn't really, you know, no cop would penalize you for doing that. Okay. And I think this business of trying to reduce everything to an algorithm and then take the algorithm and reduce it to code, this is a Roger L. Martin point. Sometimes it's hugely profitable, unbelievably efficient. You know, if you can codify a business, you've got a really profitable, highly automated business with really, really low maintenance costs, okay? You can see what the temptation is. okay? But actually allowing for discretionary judgment is what makes us human in many ways. It's the benefit of the doubt is, and you know, or if you want to go religious about it, you know, the Christian idea of forgiveness, okay? In, you know, these are technologies in a way that, you know, they've been produced in the journey from bonobo to human. And
social technologies.
Turning our back on those social technologies just because it's a bit cheaper to do it with a machine doesn't seem to me to be a great decision necessarily.
On this note of norms changing over time, what's something that was true in advertising a decade or two ago that no longer is? And what do you think is true today that won't be in a decade or two?
Most good advertising works through its appeal to human nature, which doesn't change all that much or all that fast. Trends change, fashions change, certain things change quite quickly. Other things are much slower. Okay. By the way, the reason conservatives are often right in terms of resisting rapid change is it's very easy to say we need to get, you know, in retrospect, we should have got rid of that much sooner. But when you're saying that in retrospect, you didn't have the problem of asking, well, what replaces it? Okay. That's why change, a lot of changes seem really, really slow in retrospect, even really desirable changes. But the reason is that actually changing something practically is more difficult than saying the former state was bad. You know, we'll probably look back. Okay. We'll probably look back in 50 years' time and go, what the hell were people commuting 5 days a week into an office for? Okay. But the point is that getting from that state to this state isn't just a single flash of inspiration. It requires a hell of a lot of hard work. So most good advertising, what has happened is the obsession with automation has meant that lots of advertising is produced, which is just media and some hastily contrived content. When you produced an ad in the old days, a certain amount of the media budget went towards content creation, but a certain amount of the media budget also went towards a whole bunch of ancillary services like creativity, planning, market research, okay, to ask deep questions about what is this product really for? Who wants it? When are we talking to them? Why are we talking to them? Who are we talking to? Loads and loads of questions effectively around the role of the brand and the role of the product in people's lives, okay? Now, in some ways, that process, which was funded by the content budget back then, okay, was more valuable than the advertising itself because what you learned from it, all the insights that fell out of it, like, for example, an advertising campaign for Audi in the UK. We need to make Audi more German because people don't realize it's a German car brand. And so it doesn't command the same premium as BMW and Mercedes, which everybody realizes is German. Okay, or Dove. We don't have to conform to the norms of the beauty category because this is a fundamentally different brand. Okay, those insights, which informed everything, came out of the content budget. And what's happened is that when the content budget shrinks and shrinks and shrinks in proportion to the amount of money spent on media, what you end up with is a tragic dearth of insights because the content budget that once produced the insights as a byproduct of creating content no longer really exists because the media people are so desperate to just say, give us our money and we'll give you this reach for this amount of money. That no thought goes into the communication, no money goes into the content. Now, that's a tragedy in and of itself, in that you don't see much material online that makes you cry, weep, laugh. Okay. It's very, very transactional, very short termist. In many cases, it's not really very well branded at all. Okay. That's one problem. But the even bigger problem is that in the creation of content, you went through a process that required you to have some interesting insights. And by bypassing that process, what you're losing is effectively an opportunity cost from really good insights. Because that insight, which is we need to make Audi German, which partly came out of Sir John Hegarty, a very eminent creative, wandering around the factory somewhere in Germany and seeing a sign that said Vorsprung durch Technik, which then became the strapline for Audi in the UK. Their strapline was in German. Right? It couldn't be. Okay. I mean, it was both incredibly kind of noticeable and incredibly potent in terms of repositioning. Now, that insight, which came out of a factory tour, which came out of the fact that John had to produce some Audi ads, was probably worth to Audi in the UK alone, it would amount to, I guess, £1 billion or so, of the order of magnitude, okay? If someone comes and tells me it's 150 million, I'll accept that. And if someone tells me it's 7 billion, I'll say that's probably too much. But somewhere in that kind of range, okay? And everybody's very proud of themselves because they're now producing ads more efficiently than they were before. But the problem with ads was that the byproduct was more valuable than the product. The byproduct of making an ad was actually potentially at its best, not every day, not all the time, but sometimes, was much more valuable than the product itself. Because you suddenly realized, hold on, you know, actually, this isn't about this at all. It's about that. Okay? And those insights, most unicorns basically have a really great human insight at their heart. I mean, the one that's never told is Uber, which I always tell, is that Uber map came from one of the co-founders, the Canadian one, watching the James Bond film Goldfinger, seeing the car tracking tool in the dashboard of the DB4, and basically having this kind of moment of epiphany where he goes, that's what should happen when you order a cab. You should be able to see where the cab is. You know, they could do it in the film in 1963, four, don't know, seven. You can definitely do it with modern technology. It's just GPS mapping. It's a piece of piss. Okay, but that's a brilliant, brilliant psychological insight into humanity, which is it's not the length of the wait that bothers us. It's the quality of waiting time, which derives from the degree of uncertainty you feel while waiting. That's the kind of insight you really look for, you know.
Over the decades, what have been the mega step changes or evolutions in your worldview or in your the maps of reality you've created for yourself and the causes of those evolutions?
One of the biggest ones was, oddly, because I disagree with him about a hell of a lot, but by God, he's a good writer, was reading books like The Selfish Gene, Climbing Mount Improbable. There was a book by, what's the name? Which was called Life's Grandeur in the it's called Full House, which is by another evolutionist. So reading extensively in evolutionary biology, which basically made me think of things backwards, much more than other people tend to do if you haven't had this epiphany. Now, one of the things I'd like to talk about actually is the extraordinary connection between evolutionary biology and comedy. Because if you look at it, okay, you've got Ricky Gervais, who's obviously absolutely fascinated by evolutionary biology. Jimmy Carr, who I think has just broken the US. You've got this amazing guy called Andrew Schultz, right? You've got Chris Rock. You've got Dave Chappelle. All of them basically have this kind of evo psych aspect to their comedy, I think. And obviously, you know, it plays into things like gender difference and so forth, which is why it often creates a, you know, a huge amount of upset and so on. But that is the Darwinian insight. It's like the Copernican insight, right? It's like, oh, I see. So we're not actually at the center of things. And these things aren't here because they're planned. It was once said by a brilliant evolutionary thinker. I can't remember who it is. Things are the way they are because they got that way. And so that tendency to think backwards is very akin, I think, psychologically to two things. Not coincidentally, there's a passage in one of the Sherlock Holmes stories where Sherlock Holmes, I think it's a sign of four, but it might be a study in Scarlet, where Holmes says, does this long discussion about the importance of reasoning backwards. And he says, for every person who can reason forwards, there's not one in a thousand who knows how to reason backwards, even though it's not difficult. You just need a kind of epiphany to think of things backwards. And the reason I think it's not coincidental that appears in Sherlock Holmes is I think detective work is effectively reasoning backwards, okay? You're not asking, okay, we've got this corpse here, what's going to happen next? Which is what we've evolved naturally to do. What happens next, okay? You have to ask a much more creative question, which is what could the precondition, what could the what could the previous events have been and the previous preceding conditions have been that led to this outcome of someone being on the floor with a knife in their heart? And that's a different process to induction or deduction, which are kind of reasoning forwards. What next? If this, then that. Okay. Instead, you're asking this question, how could things have got that way? So one of the bits of recommendation I do is I actually recommend creative people read quite a lot of evolutionary biology. I recommend they read a lot of or watch a lot of true life crime, about detective work in particular. And I also recommend, but I can't do this in the US because you don't have them, that they do a thing called cryptic crosswords, which we have in Britain. They have them in Canada, actually. They have them in Australia, New Zealand. India has them. But the US, almost alone in the English-speaking world, funnily enough, they exist in Hebrew and they exist in Polish as well, these kind of cryptic crosswords. There was only one in the United States, which was in Harper's Magazine. It was the only cryptic crossword that you had in the US. But I obviously haven't got time to explain this. It would take hours to explain what's happening. But these are kind of beautiful little word puzzles which you have to solve. And what's interesting about it is sometimes you solve them forwards. You use the clue to fill in the word. And sometimes you get the word from the cross-checked letters. You go, that word looks an awful lot like deer, for example, right? Okay. But why does the clue indicate deer? And it turns out that the start of the clue is does perhaps. Okay. And then he realizes, that's not does, meaning deer. It's does, the plural of a female deer, right? Okay. So then he's extraordinary. And they are absolute works of art. I mean, the cryptic crossword is something, you know, it's just at its best, a cryptic crossword clue is a little work of art. It's just a bit of kind of, I suppose, sort of cryptological genius. Those are the kind of things which help you practice reasoning backwards. And so there's that kind of Copernican revolution. Then there's the Darwinian thing, stroke the detective thing, which is Darwin was a detective, not a scientist, really. He is, why would all these finches have different beaks? And then he had to work backwards from there. And I suppose the other one is, you know, the other one is effectively the understanding that our unconscious is doing quite a bit of the work, and that our conscious is effectively generating a propaganda film for our own survival or reproductive prospects. It's not really showing us what is. It's showing us what needs to be seen. A further epiphany read I had. Okay. And by the way, I don't think it's coincidental that the most interesting thinkers in business are often kind of evolutionary thinkers. You had, you know, the Austrian school in economics. You have people like Drucker. Okay. They're kind of evolutionary thinkers. They're engaged in inquiry, not in what you might call forwards reasoning. And another epiphany I read the other day, which fascinates me, is, so the final epiphany is kind of a perceptual one, which is that effectively, okay, this is technically called phenomenology, that it is not in our evolutionary interest to perceive things objectively, where we have information presented to us in whatever form maximizes our reproductive and overall fitness, okay? And therefore, we detect contrast more than we detect absolutes. That's one example. Another example would be, obviously, we disproportionately pay attention to things that are unexpected. And I finally read this book, which I'll really recommend, by a guy called Andy Clark, who's a Brit based at the University of Sussex and the University of Melbourne, I think. But it's called The Experience Machine. And it effectively posits that the whole of human perception is very largely a prediction, and that the point of our sensory apparatus, whether it's proprioception, eyes, ears, etc., is simply to minimize the use of bandwidth by not forming the picture of the world, but by simply pointing out predictive errors. Now, if you think about it, that's how you do JPEGs. That's how you do TV, okay? You don't describe every pixel on your TV in painstaking detail, because that would mean that the amount of bandwidth required to broadcast or to stream a film would be absolutely enormous if films were in RAW. Instead, there's an expected value to a given pixel, which is related both to the pixel before it and the pixels next door. And you only use information to correct those instances where the expected value differs. So it's really interesting that evolution seems to have come up with the same information architecture as Samsung, you know, okay, right, or DirecTV or whatever it is.
It's a bit how AI works as well.
And it, well, this is interesting because it's kind of then, it's kind of Bayesian. And I was meeting a guy, I don't normally hang out with people as eminent, but I was hanging out with Sir Patrick Vallance, who was the government's chief scientific advisor. And I was talking to him about this, and he said that robotic movement looks really shit because human movement is Bayesian. In other words, it's forever correcting, okay? It's, in other words, it's starting out with an intention, and it only uses movement to correct from deviations from what is intended, okay? And that the big progress, apparently, in having robots walk and do things like open doorknobs is you stop having a kind of intentional model and you replace it with an error correction model. Now, I don't know anything about this, but if anybody knows about this and wants to get in touch with me, I'd love to know more about robotic movements and the use of effectively a kind of Bayesian procedure, because it strikes me as really interesting. But then it suddenly occurred to me, well, first of all, it explains why stage magic works, because the magician creates an expectation and that's all you see. Because as long as you didn't see enough to actually correct for your expectation, you see the expectation, okay? Mm. That's the first thing. And secondly, of course, it explains the importance of marketing, because what something is, okay, what we expect of something affects how we experience it. Simple as that. There's no such thing as Coke in the absence of our expectation of Coke, our associations with Coke, etc. They don't actually exist. And actually, you know, occasionally what this does is it causes me to get very, very exercised about things that businesses don't bother about. So for a short time in the UK, and I have no idea why they did this, Coke sold Diet Coke. Coke Zero has a black cap, right? Classic Coke has a red cap. Coke Zero typically, Diet Coke typically has a silver or a white cap. I think it's mostly white now, okay? But it's never been red. And for some weird reason, Coke started putting red caps. I don't know whether they ran out of white caps or there was some, you know, supply chain issue or whether they just wanted to simplify things. They started putting red caps on Diet Coke. And I immediately got in touch with them and said, you're nuts. Okay, you can't do this. But the reason I noticed it is for the whole period in which there were red caps on the top of a bottle of Diet Coke, I couldn't drink it. Okay, literally, I couldn't drink it. I didn't buy any. I didn't drink any. And then now, my hunch is they noticed a pretty rapid falling off in sales because they very, very rapidly reverted to the silver cap or the white cap. I can't remember. So this is what's so fascinatingly interesting, that actually, if we actually perceive what we expect, then the creation of the expectation is a very large part of the creation of the product and its value. So that turns marketing from being an optional extra into an absolutely unavoidable precursor to any kind of, you know, business activity, which is where I think it belongs. And by the way, I don't think marketing belongs there in a dominant role, but I think I don't want to live in a world where marketers sort of, you know, sign the safety systems on planes or something, right? I'm not nuts. I'm just saying that marketing and psychological solutions should be available much higher up the decision tree than they are.
There's a simple either adjacent idea to or corollary to Chesterton Spence here about behavior, lovely. Which is don't try to change human behavior unless you understand why they're behaving in that way, unless you understand the perceptions that led to that behavior. To the Coke example.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it's also interesting because we're designing a world with algorithms for people who work heuristically. And actually, you know, there's a thing in, funnily enough, there's a thing in, I think, both AI and in algorithm thinking, which is called the alignment problem. And it's the fundamental fact that computational systems, as they currently are fundamentally misaligned. Their priorities are fundamentally misaligned with the kind of things that humans care about. They optimize for the wrong thing. Now, that's fine if you've got an closed internal system which doesn't interface with the customer or the employee. But the second that system interfaces with employees, you've got yourself a problem.
Right. Well, the final question I ask to all guests in closing is, what's one question you'd leave me and listeners with, whether to think about or act on?
Bloody hell. I'm going to have a silly question first, which is, would everything be better if it were accompanied by a mariachi band? Right. Because somebody once asked me, what would you do if you won the lottery? And I jokingly said, I'd do everything I do currently, but accompanied by a mariachi band, which would just both be uplifting and fundamentally amusing. You know, this is Mr. Sutherland. He's here to talk about behavioral science. So that's my stupid question. Okay. It's rather like the stupid question I ask. There was a wonderful stupid question. Is there any food which isn't improved by the addition of cheese? Okay. Those are the kind of questions I love. Agreed. Now, I'm just going to go off on a little digression here, which is,
please.
There was a comedian, a famous comedian, whose great fantasy, which tragically will now never be fulfilled, was to interview Neil Armstrong for an hour without mentioning the moon landing once. Okay, right. Okay. And I've always wanted to do a podcast where you interview unbelievably eminent thinkers, but talk about total trivia. Like, you know, you get the philosopher John Gray on,
or perhaps
Slavoj Žižek, okay? And you just go, so where'd you like to go on holiday? What do you think would win in a fight between a badger and a baboon, right? You know, all those kind of things, right? So now I did manage this once with Daniel Kahneman, where I was interviewing Daniel Kahneman about the concept of noise. And I managed to reduce the conversation to a 15-minute exposition about a speed camera on the M11 near Chigwell, outside London, which you can go and search for it online if you want to have it. But that was my proudest moment of total trivialization. But the reason I'm very, very trivial, okay, and deliberately so, we actually have a mantra in the Ogilvy Behavioral Science Practice, which is dare to be trivial, is that real complex life is fractal, okay? It's recurring patterns. And just as you could have said, look at that fucker there, looking at those finches' beaks, right, of Darwin. There's just as much of truth to be revealed in looking at trivial things as there is looking at the kind of self-aggrandizing thing like macroeconomics. Okay, if you want to inspire yourself, there's just as much sort of insight to be found in the weeds as there is in the heavens, in a way. And so as a consequence of that, I make absolutely no... That's a third annoying feature of creative people. They procrastinate, okay? They ask silly questions, and they have no sense of proportion. And so the question I would ask, which is that how, okay, there are ad agencies, there are obviously, you know, there are obviously hugely creative people in the music, fashion industry, etc. But how do we get some of this creativity, if you like, packaged so that it can have a wider, just a wider influence? I'm not a power crazed person at all. I don't want to boss people around. What bothers me is when people make decisions through a very sequential forward reasoning process without even considering the alternatives. And so, how can we effectively? What can we do? Is it the education system, which I know is a specialism of yours? Is it more cryptic crosswords, because the solution might be really trivial? Okay. Is it, you know, more detective fiction or more true life crime? What is it that can make people better at thinking in two directions? That's all. That would be the question I'd leave you with. And the mariachi one, of course.
Of course. Excellent. Well, Rory, thank you so much. This is a ton of fun and educational as always. And I'm looking at my list here and I have probably 15 other questions that maybe we can get to some other time in the future.
Okay. No, I'm very happy to do a follow-up. No problem at all.
Great. We'll get it on the books.